opportunity to come together as a community. And we actually started this as part of a broader program, Remembering Who We Are, which began when the pandemic hit. And we were thinking, what is it that we can do to really serve this community and to serve anybody who would come and join us? And we thought opening up our own, what we call spiritual start, the way that we would start the day to have a spiritual orientation and be really aligned with the self, opening that up to the public was what we felt we could offer people, which we couldn't think of any other thing that would be more beneficial than really being aligned with the actual self, the soul. So we began Remembering Who We Are, and this special series of On the Brink of Death comes at the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of our Remembering Who We Are weekly gathering at the same time. And this program is designed to help us with the different challenges that we face, to see that even in the light of the most extreme challenges, facing death itself, we can live as the real self. We can experience the soul. And so we have an amazing guest that we are really excited to offer the presence of, Satchinandan Swami, who has been faced with so many life-threatening situations and will be telling the story of several of them. In this episode, he will focus in on a story of how he was on the brink of death and what are the learnings that he got from that for our benefit. And so the story will be the bulk of the session, and with any remaining time, then we can open up for questions. We will close at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and then we'll have a half an hour with Satchinandan Swami for question and answer. So then at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time, for those of you who would like to stay with us, that will wrap the Q&A. And you can send your questions throughout the session to Michael. So you can direct message Michael anytime you have a question, and then he will share and will ask as there is opportunity. So just a point about the culture that we're trying to create together. We value three things very highly. Respect. We want this to be a really safe space where there is a lot of respect that people can feel palpably. We also ask for full-hearted participation. So whether you are asking a question, whether you're in listening mode, whatever we're doing, let us be fully present, full-hearted, and open and receptive. Let us please not be divided or multitasking. And it's also super helpful to have your video on for that purpose, and also just so that we can be really a community together and see each other. The last thing is determination. So we don't want to just hear something today and say, oh, that was nice. You know, I really enjoyed that. What we want is the determination to live these teachings. It's such an opportunity to hear from Satchinandan Swami, his experiences, his realizations. And if we are determined to become receivers, the benefit, I can assure you, will be immeasurable. That is my own experience. And so Satchinandan Swami is my guru. He is someone who is writing and teaching, and he's traveled all over the world sharing his practices and philosophy from the bhakti tradition. He's been a monk for 50 years practicing, and has just such a fascinating life that we couldn't resist showcasing these stories of being on the brink of death for you. So with that, we are really honored to welcome each of you and Satchinandan Swami. I turn it over to you. Thank you so much for being with us from Germany.
So thank you all very much to again come on this call on the brink of death. Today we will go into a learning experience which death or almost death presented to me on a golden tablet, I could say. To start with, I should say that I felt drawn very early to the spiritual path. My father was quite active under Adolf Hitler in the Second World War, and when he came back from the war and decided to have a family, he was torn because of the experience he had made. The experience being that life is just so evanescent, I think you call it. It evaporates so easily under the forces of time and history that the question is really there, what is the real meaning of this short episode which we call life? And yes, he would ask these questions at the evening dinner table, and maybe it was his persistent questioning of any material goals that made me take up the spiritual path so early. I remember he once quoted a quotation and of C.G. Jung, and I had forgotten it, but I asked him just recently what that was, and he provided it to me. He said, "The main driving force, so far as it is possible for us to grasp, seems to be in essence only one thing, an urge towards self-realization." What Jung means with self-realization is something a little bit different from the different spiritual traditions. He means more self-actualization, that is, to really live your life fully and come to realize the various opportunities and layers that are coming with your personalities. Yes, so that drive to fully realize the opportunities which life had given to me made me turn into a monk when I was quite young. I left my higher education, I left my friends, and in short, I left my entire old life. I became like I'm dressed now. Short hair, I had a very artistic hair dress, and simple monk clothings. It was quite radical for my friends. Years later, after I had turned a monk, maybe 20 years or so later, they had a reunion. All the friends who were in this one class, and they wanted to know who everyone, what everyone had become. And one was a politician, another is a physicist who works in Geneva, to find in an atom, what is it called? A collider, atom collider, where they want to find the finest and subtlest past parts of matter. Another is a director of a radio program, and so on. And somehow they spotted me. Somehow they could find me, and they invited me also. So after we had discussed what has become out of you, and after we had shared our favorite memory in the school class, they said, what you did was so radical for us. We even didn't know where to find you. There was a rumor amongst us friends that you had become a lama in Tibet. And when you crossed the Himalayas to come to India, you fell down an abyss in the mountain and died. But there were talks about you that you had become an accomplished yogi and you had followers. So that was that type of talk was there. That type of reaction was going on to my own choice. Yes, I had left everything behind. But what had I gained? My dear people, spiritual life is not so much about what you leave behind. It's about what you gain. Negation in itself is not yet life. And I had to learn that. I had to learn it from the greatest teacher, death, or the threat of death. My story starts around 1976. I was 22 years old, and I, as I said to you, had really left so much behind, but I had not really gained anything. The space inside was clear of old stuff, but it needed to be filled with love and trust and a deep, deep knowing I have arrived at the perfect place. That was not there. Instead, I felt restless. I live a life of a very poor man. I come from such a different background. I live such a simple life. I had heard that most of my friends were on the way of material progress, but I had not gotten anything, neither in the material sphere, nor the spiritual sphere. And at that time, when I was slightly insecure, something kicked in that I have come to term as the inner critic. I do know that this is a common term in psychology, but maybe I want to tell you what I mean with this. When we are not in our strengths, there's a voice, a relentlessly speaking voice to us. Oh, look at you. You are too fat. Oh, look at you. You are not knowing anything. Oh, look at you. You have not achieved anything. A relentless inner critic that speaks from a subconscious realm to us. and seems to spit into everything which we do so that we cannot enjoy anything of it. That was really very pronounced. In fact, I always remembered a confrontation which my father had with my spiritual teacher. He had met him earlier that year when he visited Germany, and my father was a little angry at him. "You have taken my son from the path of material progress, which I have developed for him. He should be by now on the way to become a CEO, but you have taken him. But this won't work." My father had said, "You are trying to bring a culture from India, a spiritual culture, to Germany. This is as if you want to transplant a crocodile from the river Nile in Egypt into the river Rhine." Rhine is a river which goes through central Germany. It's a vast river. I mean, not as big as the Hudson, but almost as big. "What will happen if you bring a crocodile which is used to a warm habitation and then transplant it into a cold river of a different climate? So how can you hope that this spiritual culture of India will make it in the West? You have set up my son for failure." That is my accusation against you. My spiritual teacher had listened very carefully, and then he had told my father, "The son is not a member of the East or the West. In the same way, true spiritual wisdom and the spiritual path is not Eastern or Western." And then he had said his punchline, which my father, who's now 96 years, still remembers fondly. He said, "You can become enlightened in your suit and tie." In other words, you don't have to change anything in the cultural field, because this is not about Eastern culture, Western culture. Stay in your Western culture, but practice the spiritual path, which is of universal relevance. It has an overarching value. Anyways, so I was in that space where I had just withdrawn from the world, but I had not yet found my real spiritual identity. And in that space, these nagging doubts, will it work? Is it not too Eastern? Will it work even for my own mind? They're haunting me, yes, and spoiling everything. What I learned later is something which I want to read to you to make the problem really clear and put it before everyone. It's something which I have discussed, it's an author whom I have discussed with Hari Prasad, Richard Rohr. He writes in a very good book, Falling Upward. He writes, "The sacred space is where your old world is able to fall apart. But the new world has not yet emerged. This is the liminal space in our life. If you don't dare to to go into this liminal space, you will start idealizing normalcy. In other words, he encourages us, yes, start your spiritual journey, be bold, move forward. But he also says, this is a state where we are betwixt and between the familiar and the completely unknown. This threshold is God's waiting room. Here we are taught openness and patience as we come to expect an appointment with a divine doctor. Imagine you understand, I think many on this call are in this situation. They also know, this materialistic life is really not what I want. It lacks substance. It does not fulfill me. But now we have come into the waiting room. We don't yet know what will be the new life. He says, this is a threshold. And he says, here we expect an appointment with a divine doctor, divine intervention that makes it clear, this is your new life, this is your new path, this is your new identity, this is what you are meant to be and to live. Very nice, very nice quotation. For me, something happened in the waiting room that catapulted me forward and made me really into the person which I started to become. It was a process, but I was set on the right way. I told you already, it was the year 1996. I had gone to Berlin. The idea was to open a space where people could come and learn spiritual life. The schedule was like this. I was getting up early at around 4 o'clock. Then I had a very extensive morning program together with the other monk, Jaigora. And around 7 o'clock, not around, it was on the minute, at 7 o'clock we would meet for a little ceremony, and then we would do some reading together and discussion, and the whole program ended around 8:30 every day. I must say, the only time in that time when I was full of doubts and unwell and waiting in the waiting room with nothing happening really, the only good time for me was this time when I was in my morning practice and when I was in that room which we called the temple room. Yes, we were running a spacious spiritual center in the midst of Berlin. After the morning program, we would be very, very busy. I have written it down. We would invite the public to come. I would give classes in meditation or philosophical lectures. I taught the Bhagavad Gita at that time. And then during the day, I would be outside giving lecture appointments. I always spent 2 hours a day sitting as a monk in the center of Berlin and making music, meditational music right there. And there was always a huge crowd of people around me. Sometimes they were challenging, some were asking very submissive questions. The police was going by in the car. They looked at that unusual monk who had a huge discussion right there on the street. And they said, oh, monk, let the monk do. You know, we need a few peaceful people in the town. it was like this. So one Sunday morning, my busy, empty world exploded. I call it busy. I was doing many, many things, but the heart was empty because I had not yet received a very clear indication of identity, of inner arriving. To be busy, Socrates said, beware of a busy, empty life. So I was overcompensating my emptiness with a lot of activity. So it was Sunday morning. I don't know how it is in New York, but in Berlin, everyone is asleep at Sunday morning, except the two monks who were doing their rigid morning program and so on. We had come on that day to the end of the reading, and we, at the end of the reading, we did something. We bowed down, we paid our obeisances. Then something happened so fast. First I heard gunshots, then bullets just digging themselves centimeters above me into the wall. Then I remember I was covered with this white plaster from the walls. And then I heard the sound of screeching wheels of a car driving at fast speed away from us. I got up from my obeisances. I looked at the other monk and I said, what was that? And he said, we just have been shot at. I didn't hear the end. We just had been shot. So I thought this was an afterlife situation. I was so bewildered because it was just so loud and so aggressive and so absolutely different and such a... that I was really bewildered. I looked around. I saw the bullets in the wall. Jaigora, the older monk, had run out to see who it was, but he came back and he said, I saw a car around the corner, but it could be any car. I did not, and I don't know what car it is. Someone shot at us, wanting to kill us. And then I understood. And I've made a little drawing for you so that you understand the situation. Our temple had a big window like this. It was 3 meters and something high. Then there was a little wall. I'm sorry, I'm a terrible drawer, I know. You don't need to have an inner critic to know that. And here there was the entrance door, and here we were, the two, sitting. So this is the car who came, and this is supposed to be the gun. So the car was shooting at us, but we went down. You know, when he took aim, in other words, we were sitting up like here. Then He shot, and in the milliseconds, thong, we went down on the floor, not avoiding the bullets, but doing our pious obeisances. It was a perfect timing to save our lives, and we really understood the whole situation. Wow! This was the reaction of some criminal part of the society. They were not pleased with our monk activities and our bringing spiritual value in the society. In Berlin, there's a huge mafia. I know this because one of my disciples is a criminal officer. She's a woman. She says, if you would know what the underworld it is, I will not tell you. It's not good for you to know. It's so vast and so on. And someone had either hired killers or killers were on our case. You know, Germany was not known in the past for being very tolerant. I think they are learning the society, but it was at that time very critical towards spiritual life and monks who were outside of Christianity. My dear listeners, it was so mind-shattering. When we looked out, the window had come down. There was no window. This large, huge, 4 meters windows, it was broken. When we looked on the wall, there were a few bullets for each one of us. The plaster was there. But this, to understand, we were in the only room where we felt very well, the sacred space of the temple. And right into this room, violence had entered. But the real learning was not even that. This was what happened. Each day afterwards, I was thinking, they had come to kill you. They had not negotiated anything. There was no discussion. There was just the very brutal intention to kill you. They had failed this time because they didn't know that a monk sometimes pays some obeisances as part of his morning ritual. They will come again. And each day I lived between two poles. The confidence that there is something like protection for people who are following their spiritual calling. There is a divine umbrella above them. But then the fear, the very real fear of being an object of violence and being killed by bullets or by knives or by whatever my killers or those who wanted to assassinate me would choose. Every morning when I woke up, I oscillated, I went between these extremes, fear and confidence. And I understood that these two poles are there within our human nature. Fear of the unknown and confidence that if I follow my spiritual calling, that calling for self-realization, everything will be all right due to divine protection. That these poles, I understood, are there all the time working. And I need to come to grips with it. I need to understand it. And I need to come to a place where I can balance these. Before you have reached your spiritual confidence, your spiritual realization, there's always fear. Enter the opposite within you. And you need to find some way to balance it. I needed to do it because sometimes the fear got so big in me that I didn't want to go out any longer. I didn't want to continue in Berlin, although we had paid the rent for this really big spiritual center, and although people had showed interest and apparently got something out of it, I didn't know, because they had come to kill me and they had failed once, but I was a public person. They would come again and shoot at me again, and this time they would most probably get me and kill me. This was the classroom. I needed to come to terms with this. The situation was eating at me day and also in the night in the form of my dreams. And I found a solution which and I think because of that, this learning experience had been arranged to me, that I was shot at in the midst of the temple. I needed to find my spiritual identity, my spiritual calm, my spiritual place. I didn't just need to give up the old life. What I learned is that we have the choice between what is called a material perspective and a spiritual perspective. And by choosing the spiritual perspective, the soul life, if you so want, the perspective of the spiritual identity, we become fearless. I did this in the form, I developed a little meditation, and it is this meditation that I wish to share with each one of you on the call. I don't want to speak theoretically now. I want to speak practically now. I don't wish to tell you my experience. I wish that you make your experience, where you negotiate between these poles, which are always there. Fear of the unknown and confidence, which gives you the strength to move forward into that waiting room of God, if you so will, where you are open to new experiences in your own life. I see already some of you are smiling because you know. I've seen four people before me. You know that now something meditative comes, an experience. Just allow me to get my materials ready. Yes, I am actually ready now. I request all of you to find a peace, to find a good position to sit. Some of you might like the chairs. I think they're fine. I have seen our Michael sitting on the floor. That's also good. The main thing is that you want to sit tall and straight and open your shoulders a little bit by rolling them back. Why? You want to increase the space for your breathing here. Just to tune us in. In this meditation, we will exit whatever it is that we are doing, and we will try to find our spiritual anchor place. You know, in this world, there are many distractions. The job can be a distraction, or various relationships that are not essential, society, and so on. All these preoccupations are like smoke, and one day they will simply dissolve into thin air. We need to arrive at the soul life, the essential life, our true nature. I request you to first of all do a simple centering exercise. Become aware of your feet. Some of you might like to wiggle with the toes. And relax them. Go up from your feet to your knees. And then your sitting bones. And relax. Move up your spine, your back, and relax. Your chest and your belly area, relax. Both of your shoulders, arms, and hands, relax. The back of your neck, the back of your head, relax. Top of your head, your forehead, your eyes, relax. If you have not yet done so, close your eyes. Focus on your cheeks and relax. And finally, your tongue. Relax. Do a few deep breaths. In and out. Whenever you breathe in, know that you breathe in. And whenever you breathe out, know that you breathe out. Conscious breaths. Imagine you're completely alone. And let everything that is going on in your life right now gently disappear. Bring your attention to these things in your life and let them disappear. Your various relationships gone. Your job gone. Your important responsibilities gone. Future desires gone. You're now absolutely free to simply be present. Move your attention now to the heart area. And as you continue to breathe, breathe into your heart space. It is here, in the heart space, that the soul is, the self is. We will listen to a wisdom text from the Gita. For the soul there is neither birth nor death at any time. He has not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever existing and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Continue to breathe into your heart space and simply feel the existence of that soul, that unaffected self. Continue to breathe in and out. Simply be in that space. The soul is full of inner knowing. It is eternal. And it is full of bliss. free from the disturbances of the environment. Do a few deep breaths now. Slowly become aware of your environment. Open your eyes and look at your room as if you're seeing it for the first time, even the pictures in your room. When you're ready, look at your screen. That's how we say nowadays, look at your screen again. I thank you very, very much. I think we had a little technical interference with one of our participants trying to find the mute button, and it worked out in the end. We were successful. Michael, I don't see you. Are you in samadhi, in trance? Oh yeah, the head is there. Yes. No, you may be there. I just need to take full responsibility of my guided meditation here. I thank you so much, everyone. I can feel. Maybe it's the training which one has as a monk. I can feel the community, the common humanity, which is created. Oh, here, someone, my phone dropped. I hope you found it again. Yes. Yes, this is full experience. We should have everything drop away at times. Sometimes we need to start with our telephone. My dear people, it's very simple. The lesson here, which I learned, is it's not enough to leave things behind. It's very important to arrive at the place of the soul, not theoretically, but very practically. And this possibility is there at every time. Now, I do this meditation in an abbreviated form. Whenever in all situations. For instance, today I went out on a walk and sat by the lake, and I just breathed in and I mentally divested myself of all the things which are going on, just like I take off the pullover and other cloth when I go in the evening to bed and put them to the side. So in the same way, I mentally put all the things to the side, and then it's magical. Then you breathe into the heart space where the soul is and just become aware of it. And as you become aware, as you point, so to say, the torchlight of your awareness in that direction, it begins to reciprocate. It comes out of the darkness and becomes more feelable, more experienced. And I could see it from time to time. I looked at the gallery and I could see some of you were really entering, first of all exiting, but then entering the new spiritual space. Another way to do that is to read in the texts of the Bhagavad Gita regularly, and then just stop everything, also your reading, relax your body, go to your breathing. My spiritual teacher says breathing is the bridge to the mind, and you come to the mind and you calm it. By calm breathing you calm the mind, and then you remember what you have just now read in the wisdom text, and dwell in that place. And because this is a reality, it's not an imagination, it is a reality, it will begin to shine into your life, and you will feel it in your life, not theoretically, not conceptually, but in an experienced way. That is what I had to learn when I was gripped with fear and anxiety after that armed attack on me in Berlin, where the killers wanted to kill me. I had phoned we had spoken with the police, and we showed them the bullets and so on. And they said, do you have any information who it was? Like Jaigora said, well, it could have been from the car, because but I saw the car, but I was so shocked that I forgot the color of the car, and it may not have been that car. You know, they were obviously professionals. They didn't leave a trace, only the bullets, but there were no fingerprints on the bullets. It was the police said, well, we have so much to do in Berlin. If we ever find a clue, we will let you know, but we can tell you it's very rare that we find such killers. So therefore we had to live in the fear, but also with the experience that we were miraculously saved. I mean, it was a split, what is it called in English? A nanosecond in which we were felt inspired to do our obeisances, something which the killer had never seen in his life. And therefore we were spared. Fine, I will stop here. I know that some of you have to exit by the hour, but Hari Prasad will be able to continue for another half an hour. I just wanted to announce the next and last episode is really my most dramatic episode. I will call it In the Heart of War. I will not be able to say anything more, because it is meant to be a cliffhanger which awakens your interest. So I cannot, it's a surprise. Good, so I'm for now, I want to say over to you, Hari Prasad.
Thank you so much, Sachinanda Swami. It's thrilling to be with you and to hear from the wild experiences that you've had and what you've gained is so meaningful. Thanks to everyone who has joined us today and for your wonderful participation, receptivity. Means a lot to us to be able to share this with you. We wish you a wonderful week for those of you who need to exit now, and we'll be back next week at the same time for the last episode of this On the Brink of Death series, episode 5. Thank you very much. And for those who would like to stay on, we're very happy to have you for our Q&A now. Thank you so much. So I would like to start with a question. Why did it take getting shot at to come to this point? And how did that connect with your inner critic giving you trouble, not finding your identity? It took getting shot at to overcome the inner critic stopping you from finding your identity. How did you also come to that space? So a couple of questions in there. Why getting shot at? And how did you then get to arrive at this space when you've been practicing for so many years?
I thank you very, very, very much. Let me look at this question from the perspective of neuroscience and then yoga psychology. In neuroscience, we hear that if we repeatedly do something or think a thought, we are hardwiring this thought in our brain. There is a very nice, easy statement. Neurons that fire together, wire together. They build a very, very intricate and hardwired network, which is very difficult to change. Especially habits are so hard to change. I think during this lockdown period, when we can't really distract ourselves with so much outside activities, we see how habits which are there within us, habits in thinking, but habits also in acting, are kicking in, and we thought, oh, it would be nice to give them up, but it's really difficult. There have been whole libraries full of books which give tips on how to break the habit of being me. For instance, I had this book, this was sent to me just for Christmas. I got it from someone. To break habits is not easy. From the yoga psychology, habits, both in thought and in action, are like riverbeds that are deeply ingrained in the ground and that force the flow of the water to always go according to the way it has flown already since centuries sometimes. To dig a new riverbed and then bring the water to flow into this is a huge effort. So in spiritual life, we do make some advancement, but we come also against what I always call a wall that we cannot cross any longer, that we cannot cross. My wall in the beginning, in that period which I describe, was that doubter who doubts that spiritual life is really there. Yes, I had concepts. Yes, I had gave lectures, but inside of me, I was dissatisfied. I felt my life was not moving on. I was far away from the experience of real spiritual life, which is a blissful experience. An experience which I also call being above the clouds. I was fully under the clouds of my mind and my upbringing and so on. I was, so to say, I had made my camp on the threshold and I didn't move beyond the threshold. So if that is there, we need, I will give a colloquial term for this, a wake-up call. My dear people, it doesn't always have to be a machine gun. Please don't fear that it will also happen to you. Then you will think this world of life is a dangerous affair. No, no. But for a monk like me who had chosen a rather intense experience and an intense path, I seem to have needed that. Or at least that was the treatment given to me. If I'm perfectly transparent to all of you, maybe painfully transparent, I am a hard nut to crack. I'm the son of a warlord. My father, if you would hear what he did, you would never speak to me again in the Hitler times. And there is not, there is, it's not by chance that we come into our families, no, in the good, in the families which we are. So I have a spiritual searcher is there, yes, but I think there is also, how do you say in good English, a hard nut to crack is also there, and I may have even called for the hammer to do the work, but it does not have to be that extreme. It is mostly not so extreme. It was extreme in my life because I was, yeah, I brought a lot of karma with me that attracted such intense experiences. By the way, since a few years, nothing that intense has happened. Of course, no, yeah, three years ago, when I was in Florida, a huge crocodile came after me. I thought, why always me? But my good, I'm traveling with Gaur Krishna, my assistant. He is a jewel. I will introduce him. He's here. He was in the same boat when we went through the jungle. He didn't even see the crocodile. But there was a third person who saw the crocodile. It was not a crocodile in my mind only, in other words. But he doesn't need such experiences. He is not such a hard nut to crack.
Thank you so much. We have a question from Vijay. What advice do you have for us to skillfully navigate the liminal space when we have left the old, but the new has not yet emerged? What advice for getting to the new when we've left the old behind?
What a wonderful question. In fact, all the questions which I have gotten show me that you are really with the presentation and you are asking content-related questions which show that you are engaged with the subject. This is one of my most dearest subjects, to navigate the liminal space, the space in between the old and the new life. In fact, I give retreats, of different sorts of retreats, where I am trying to set up an atmosphere where everyone can make the experiences which are necessary to make in order to go and find the new life. To answer your question in brief, you have to put something in this liminal space that helps you to move on. I'm speaking of spiritual practice that is so powerful, it purifies your perception and your heart, and it really gives you new eyes through which you can see that which is already waiting for you. Spiritual practices are so important. What you practice now, that is what you become later. In my quotation, I have called this, Richard Rohr called this the threshold, no? And he gave another word, the waiting room of God. I think there are two expressions, one for the not so, let us say, religious-minded person, that's the threshold, and the waiting room of God is obviously for the religious-minded person, but it refers to the same thing. That should not just be a waiting room. You should not just sit on the threshold and pitch your tent there for a few years. No. By no means. If you, it's important that you become active with a good spiritual practice. And I have forgotten your good name, but whoever you are that you asked the question, I really want to suggest to you something. Find good spiritual people. I mean, the upbuilt people are wonderful and they are equipped to give you tips on a spiritual practice, and discuss with them so that you find a practice that is suitable for you, and a practice that is just right for you. It is important that you have not a one-shoe-fits-all practice, but a practice that is totally focused for your on your own. I would say try to see that there are three elements in the practice. Wisdom or knowledge, people who practice that, and finally, actually, I gave the wrong succession. You need some knowledge, some orientation, some guiding thoughts. Then you need a practice, and then you need to have association with people who practice it, so that you can ask relevant questions, detailed questions. I call this the three P's, which everyone who wants to move on has to know: philosophy, practice, and people. Thank you.
Wonderful. So, a question from my mom.
Oh! Can we see your mom? Ah, Pamela, I see you. Haribo. Yes.
So the question is,
Yes.
What exactly did you find in your heart as evidence of connection to your soul as a result of your life-threatening encounter?
I was so overjoyed with the fact that Sivi is there, that my joy was momentarily covering my skills of comprehension. Please again repeat the question.
What exactly did you find in your heart as evidence of connection to your soul as a result of your life-threatening encounter?
Pain can be sometimes a place from which great joy and insight is born. Mothers know this when they are in labor. It is intense experience, but then after it, the children come or the child comes out. I must say, this tremendous experience of anxiety, and maybe I was not able to connect this or to bring this to your awareness. You know, knowing that a killer is behind you, that is so, such a nerve-wracking experience. I had this once in Kabul, Afghanistan. You know, I was shadowed each day by a person. You could to turn around and you see a hand is disappearing, and the next moment you turn around and you see someone is disappearing. And I had a threat to my life. I was in Kabul, Afghanistan. I had been teaching in a school. There was a Hindu minority of Hindus from India who lived there, the Afghanistani Hindus. It's a particular ethnic group, and they had invited me to teach, and the children became really enlivened. We had painting contests, and soon even grown-up who were behind the children took part in the painting contests. And we became prominent during the fast months, the Ramadan months. And we were shadowed, and yes, there was an assassinator on my case. And I knew that experience. It had happened in earlier, 74. And now again, I knew that there were people behind me who wanted to kill me. And that is psychologically extremely unsettling. You're never safe anywhere. In that situation, that painful situation, you can say, that unsettling situation, I took shelter in my spiritual practice. I went really deep in the practice, and I came to that soul place. That soul place is always there, but most of us, when we want to go deep, we stop somewhere here and then we go out again. We go next time a little bit deeper, hopefully, we go out, and then we try again, and then we are on the surface and we don't get deeper. But this experience taught me there is no shelter for you. You almost were killed. I mean, the bullets were this much over my head, you know, it couldn't be more dramatic. And the bullets, there were more bullets. They are not so expensive for a killer who wants to kill you. That forced me to take my spiritual practice very, very deep. I did more than just the meditation in which I guided you. I did a meditation where I really, how would you say in proper English, confronted my own death. I mean, if you want, I will have a discussion with the team. We will have to see if that is a responsible meditation. Next time. Let me speak first with your son. There are meditations where you really contact your eternal essence. And at that time, Sibi, something happened which Gandhi spoke about. I will show this to you. He says, birth and death are like two boxes. which each hold the key to unlock what is in the other box. So if I go deep into the meditation of life, I will understand, well, I'm alive only because there's a life force inside of me which moves these bodies and chemicals, which is also there and energizes the mind. I come to that life force or that soul or that self. And when I go deep enough into the death box, then I will also understand, yes, I'm a mortal being, but there is no death. And with this, I'm shaking off all the fears in my life, and I begin to move around as if I'm dressed in an impenetrable armor. Nothing can happen to me. I'm an eternal soul. People who live the soul life become fearless. So the inner critic, so to say, that period of the inner critic, that was just the whipping lashes, so to say, that drove me into this, not just the experience, but the digestion and the learning of that experience. Thank you very much for your very good question. But I long to discuss at length with you, but in real, coming and visiting your house, seeing the squirrels who go up the trees and everything. Good.
The next question is from Ghislaine. I think this will be the last one, most likely. So she's offering her gratitude for your nourishing words and meditation. Would you shed some further light and insight about the hearts and minds of those who are fearful of peaceful beings like you and your fellow monk in Berlin, so much so that they're driven to violence and murder? In short, fundamentally, why do humans hurt each other?
Yeah. A monk is often such a contrast to the way people think and act that his very existence puts not only a question mark behind what the people do, but they are perceived as a threat. I would like to give you an example which has moved me very, very much. I personally profit a lot from genuine spiritual people in the various world traditions, and I particularly like the teachings of the Sufis and also the Desert Fathers. Who are Desert Fathers? They are Christian monks who have withdrawn from everything to focus only on God, and they have gone to the deserts. Syria is a place where they were. Egypt is a place. Morocco, also Tunisia. And they have made their experience in solitude and left a large body of literature with their deep insights, which, you know, are very similar to what we can hear in other world traditions who have a contemplative practice, very similar. I have seen many, many descriptions of, you know, what in my tradition is known as the various steps in meditation and so on, almost identical. Anyway, so there was such a peaceful desert father, and he was wise, and people used to come to him and to learn. I think once of a week he was opening his door or his place in the desert for people to come and ask questions. But then it was in Algeria or Morocco. My memory becomes weak at this regarding the if it's this place or that place. I tend to believe it was Algeria. It's 30 years ago or 40 years ago. I don't remember very sharply now. There was a rise of the local religion's fundamentalism, and they were not appreciating the spread of Christian wisdom. They could not see that this is the same, because for them, religion is a party effort. You know, I'm in this party, and there's the other party, and often there is some struggle between these parties for membership and other things. So they became alert, the fundamentalist of the local religion, and they sent killers after them because they thought it's a threat. Not it's an enrichment, like a true spiritual person will think, but it's a threat. Now, this desert father was killed, and next to his corpse, when he was found, a letter was found, a handwritten letter. He had written it with his own hand. He had said, "I greet you, friend of my last hour." This was addressed to his killer, no? "I greet you, O friend of my last hour." So beautiful, so beautiful. "And I pray to the one God who's all of our Father, that when you come to me, I'm able to see you as he would see you." That is one of his children. This is seeing the true equality of all beings. But if you think spirituality and religion is a party thing, then you will find in this letter even a grave challenge. Maybe he's want to say that his religion is better than our. It is, this is my understanding, they perceive someone who is so different as a threat. And don't we sometimes also do this in our own way? This is common in the psychology of man, to view difference not as a welcome enrichment or enhancement, but to see it as a threat. And now, how exactly this goes on? I'm not a psychologist. I can't say. And I want to say, I don't even want to know, because it is so dark. You want to really understand it, you have to go into pitch black darkness. But not just the darkness in the night, it's the darkness of the human mind, which is dangerous. There lurk many, many things. It's a sad chapter of our humanity, this judgmental spirit, but it is there, it is part of the reality, it has its place in this vast creation. And if the place is to wake us up and go against the judgment part within us and eliminate the judgment path as we come into maturity, then it serves even a good place. I thank you very much. I see the conductor of our program is here, Time. Time, and then it's also Hari Prasad. I thank you very much, and I'm very, very grateful for this Sangha or this community which we create, this invisible or even a little bit visible community, because they're gallery photos. I will now give over to Hari Prasad, and I will look for a moment at your gallery photos. Oh.
Thank you so much, Satchinandan Swami. Such an honor as ever. And thanks to everyone who stayed with us for this precious Q&A time. We can't wait to be back with you next week. We're only sad that it's just the last session. So hopefully more to come in the future. Thank you very much. Wishing you a wonderful week.
Thank you. Thank you.